Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Living Mythology, I'm proud to bring you the Pep Talk with John Carl Pepe. Greetings and welcome, John. How are you, sir?
Very good. How are you, Hercules?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to
Excellent.
Your show tonight, as always.
Yeah. This is gonna be a fun one. I always like the opportunity to I guess, you know, bring new people to other people's attention. So yeah, I guess we're gonna get right into it, folks. It is February 5th, 2023, and thank you for spending your Sunday night with us here at the Pep Talk. Thank you, Hercules, as always, for allowing me to have this opportunity to bring people. To the table, and I'm gonna say this. I have over 30 years of retail experience under my belt, and it takes a lot of grit and fortitude, and just a lot of stick-to-itiveness is something that you really really need when you're working in retail customer service environment, and I met tonight's guest under those circumstances, and this is somebody who has applied that to his retail experience, but also to his writing career. He has published, self-published 9 novels in a,
wow.
I believe he told me, a 70-book cycle, all under the umbrella of the Blauverse. So we're going to talk to him about that tonight. I guess it would be no surprise to know that his name is Alex Blau, and in order to self-publish 9 books and counting, you need a lot of that grit and fortitude and stick-to-itiveness. So, Alex, welcome to the Pep Talk. I can't wait to hear about your magnum opus, as we'll call it. So say hello, Alex.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
Thank you for being on.
Thank you for being on. I appreciate you being here. So, we're going to get right into it. Tell us right off the bat, what is the Blauverse, and what, log line summary of the first 9 books, and I guess there's a 10th that you're currently developing, and then we'll kind of get into some questions about how this all came to be. So the floor is yours, sir. Tell us about the Blauverse. Make us want to read it. Let's push some paper for you, right? Let's move some paper.
The concept of my series started in my junior year of high school with my first book. My first book was basically like a collection of stories that all had to do with one family. So like my very first book is about Native folklore through my own interpretation. So like a mystical, like unknown world of Natives across the world that, you know, like people don't know about, like a hidden society type of story.
Okay.
That book took about like 3 years to write. It was quite difficult to, you know, begin writing my first book because, you know, you just don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
But it got a lot easier as I got past the first one. So like my second one is a journal mystery book, horror mystery book written in journal format. And that one takes place on like a dark planet, completely covered in darkness, and nobody knows where that darkness came from. It's basically a set of stories about people trying to survive on that planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty interesting, like horror survival. My third one is a romantic thriller. By the way, my first title is Anima Chronicles. The second one is Journals, the Horror Mysteries, Journals from Zestiria. And then the third one that I'm talking about right now is Angelus Custos. So the romantic thriller basically is about, like, this guy wants to propose to somebody that he really loves, and they go to this forest, and they get attacked by people with masks. And he ends up dying watching her get attacked. And in death, he hears a whisper of somebody that offers him a chance to come back. And obviously he takes this chance to come back because he wants to seek revenge. But revenge always, you know, has side effects to it. So throughout the story, he struggles between right and wrong, and that the decisions he makes shapes him as a person. So that story gets pretty intense as it progresses. And then the fourth one, Kerrigan Uprising, that one's a thriller with magical elements. Basically, that story centers around a young girl named Jasmine who is in a very abusive household ruled by her mother, Azalea. And she has a few siblings with her there. And the mother constantly is overprotective and doesn't let any of them out of her sight or even go to regular school. And slowly but surely, each of her siblings, starting with the very oldest, starts to get sick throughout the story. And at one point, you know, the main character tries to investigate why this is happening. And that story has, like, a lot of hidden elements to it. And the fifth book, Daemon, is Greek mythology, which is interesting for this talk. So Daemon is Greek mythology, and it focuses on life after death. So a daemon is like a, in the story, is like a creature kind of that follows you. The main character has like an accident or something happens, and in death they've learned that everything they've been told is a lie, and that there's this creature that just waits around, and when you die, just takes you to the afterlife, and it's something, you know, us normal people have never heard of before, so... The whole story focuses on that person becoming overly obsessed with it to the point that it could potentially damage their own life. And after that book, I got very, let's say, extra creative. And my writing really changed after I hit the sixth book, which is Limbo. Okay. So for those out there that are familiar with the Divine Comedy, Limbo is basically inspired off of the Divine Comedy.
Okay.
So Limbo has my own interpretation of it where I created my own circles, my own, like, circles of hell and my own interpretation of what hell is. Mm-hmm. So that book is a straight horror book, and it focuses around this guy who wakes up in the middle of this, like, foggy forest. He doesn't know where he is. Or he has no memory either. And, you know, he walks around this, like, foggy place and finds, like, sins etched into a tree, like, etched into all the trees. And, you know, like, they're bleeding from the tree. And he figures out that he's in limbo, you know. And he, you know, this story focuses about him going through the different circles of hell on a mission to find his parents that he believes is down there. It's a very interesting story that has a lot of twists and turns, especially because most people would, let's say, like, Lucifer is the oldest thing in hell. My own interpretation is that he is not the oldest, and there are older things that have been there way before him.
Cool.
So that's my writing really started to get a little, like, more creative than I normally would have been. Yeah, so going outside the box, you know.
Yeah.
My seventh book, Tenebra, flips the script again, where this is a book set in the 1960s at an insane asylum. The main guy basically was a psychiatrist, and he has an incident that occurs where his wife, who is schizophrenic, ends up killing herself, and it causes him a lot of pain and trauma to the point that he cannot perform his job correctly. So he loses his job, and then he gets a random phone call or he gets a random, like, message from this guy, Dr. Willow, who says, hey, I have a job opening up on this island for this asylum that I run. do you want to come over here and work for me? And obviously it's strange, but he really needed the money, so he just hops up along and goes. But through this story, the main character or the readers are going to figure out that there's more to this place than what you think. It's not just an asylum. There's other types of things that are going on this place. And then the eighth book in the series is actually a sequel to that one. So, like, in my series, each book usually stands on its own and none of them have to do with each other.
Sure.
But for the first time, the seventh to the eighth is a sequel to the seventh.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of another flipping of the script. The eighth one is called Fractured. So Fractured is set in the 80s. And it explains the rise in serial killers. So it explains, like, why there was a rise in serial killers. So you could tell, like, the theme between the two might have to do with, you know, serial killers or killers or in that type of area.
Mm-hmm.
The ninth one is a straight romance book, which is the first time I've ever written romance. It's called Transcend. It basically centers around this young girl that goes to this carnival that comes to her town, and she learns that there are, like, hidden things going on at the carnival with the people that run it. And this book, like I said, is the first time I ever wrote romance. So it was pretty interesting. The hidden element, I can't really say because it would ruin the story. But it would really give it away too much. But that hidden element is something that most people in society have come accustomed to through pop culture or just like classic movies or something like that. You know, once somebody reads it, they'll be like, oh, I've seen that type of thing before. That's interesting. So it will be very familiar to people that read it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 10th one that I haven't, you know, written yet, like fully, that one will be very interesting because that's where the Blauverse plays into effect now. So my 10th one is called Somnio, which is to dream. So Somnio, basically, the main character of that one, she tragically loses her brother at a young age, and she becomes obsessed with trying to find a way to get him back. And she develops a technology throughout her life where she could travel to different dimensions, and she tries to bring some form of her brother back to her. Now, each dimension she travels to in this story is a book that I have written and a book that I have not written.
Very cool.
It varies. However, though, I'll give an example of ripple effects. So basically, her actions in this story will shape future books or shape future universes or, you know, stories to come based on her actions. So, like, for instance, one scenario could be she goes to this one planet, I mean, one world or universe, and she gets attacked by a creature, and then she jumps to a different dimension with a piece of that creature still on her, and it drops off in another dimension and infects a different area and creates a story over there. You know, there's different, like, effects based on the action. So that's where the Blauverse basically plays into. Like, that story creates the Blauverse.
Right. Gotcha.
And that actually, throughout the, like you mentioned, the 70 books that I do have planned throughout my life, because obviously 70 books takes a long time, you know. The end of the series in general ends within the realm of that 10th book story, kind of, like, in that main character's lifetime.
Brings it back to that.
Yeah, it brings it back to, like, you know, it's a funny saying that I always used to go off of, which is it ends where it begins. So that's kind of where that story is going to be that setting that story sets up will be, like, the end of the series.
Cool. I mean, 70 books is very ambitious for a lifetime. For Stephen King, I think it's, like, about a week and a half. to write so many books. That guy, you know, pumps those things out. So that's you know, that's all really fascinating. And one of the things I like about the plots that you do is that you do take sort of classic tropes or classic themes or story concepts, story ideas, and then give them this sort of dressing, this flourish. I kind of find it fascinating that your initial ones were collections of short stories that, you know, formed a larger narrative, and that they had sort of situations where we would be familiar with here on this planet, but they were taking place on other planets. And then it seems like now then you start to gravitate and actually have things take place on Terra Firma. And I like that you go back, you do the Greek mythology, and then you go also, you touch on Dante's Divine Comedy, and, you know, really shows a very well-read, you know, and well sort of versed individual. As far as your writing, maybe for your writing style, but also just for your entertainment diet, like who are some of your influences or favorite authors?
So some of my influences or favorite authors, one of them would be R.L. Stine. And I got the opportunity to see him like a few years back or a year or so back, which was really interesting. And I actually got to – I wore a shirt that to his event that had my books on him. And I even though he may have not – you know, it may not have hit him at all, but I told him that I thanked him for, you know, being the author that I grew up reading books for, and said that, you know, part of my wanting to write was because of him, and I thanked him for that.
Nice. He's for those not familiar, he's the Goosebumps author, and he also has done for my world, right? He's done some comic book work as well. He currently has a series out called Stuff of Nightmares, which I think is like an anthology horror comic book series. So a bunch of different stories, I think, with different creators, but he writes the lead story, I think, in each issue. He also, a few years ago, almost I guess about 10 years ago or so at this point, a little less, but he wrote a Man-Thing miniseries for Marvel. And I also had the opportunity to meet him at the place that we worked for, the first place, the first location in Columbus Circle that I worked at before I came to New Jersey, which is where I met you. He came into the store one day and we talked, and I think I even made a giant-sized man thing joke to him, which he got, and he laughed, and really nice guy. So that was cool. So you had that interaction with him. And you said you were wearing a shirt for one of your books, correct?
The shirt had like my first, I think, four books on it. Yeah, I was wearing it there.
And did he did he remark on it?
Yeah, he did. He said that he liked the designs of them. He thought it was cool. He said that they looked interesting.
Now you were wearing a shirt with your books on it. Did you didn't happen to have a copy of your of one of your books on you though?
No, unfortunately not. I didn't get that far.
So R.L. Stine is a big influence. Who else as far as I think for you know your writing style. I mean, you know, you don't ever want to really emulate, but, you know, there's definitely writers who set a mood, right? Or there's a way that they create that word picture that you look to as inspiration, you know?
Well, I would say besides him, Stephen King is definitely an inspiration. I've never met Stephen King. But Stephen his stories are pretty out there, abstract. I like that abstractness. And while I do take, while I have been inspired by both of them, you'll find in my books that I don't write books like normal people would. as in my books are written in book/play format.
Okay, cool.
So they're just not written like normal books would be dialogue-wise, mainly because I don't agree with the way dialogue is said to be, you know, this is how it has to be. Like, I don't agree with standard dialogue.
Format or prose. You're kind of doing a prose script hybrid almost. You're not doing strict prose. And I understand that some of those rules can be, those standard Oxford English rules can be very tricky. So I totally understand that you wanting to kind of break out and do your own thing. Have you ever considered adapting these as graphic novels, as comics?
So a lot of things have run through my mind. I've thought of adapting these through, you know, art books. I mean, I haven't really thought of too much into the graphic novel area. I've wanted to do a kid book. I've wanted to do a soundtrack. I've wanted to do, you know, video content. You know, there's a lot of things that I've wanted to do for them. It's just all about finding the right people to interpret them. I write the books and design the covers, but when you branch out into areas that aren't your expertise, you need the right people to craft it. People that, you know, understand what you're for.
And you got to also, you know, you got to get, be able to pay them too, as well. A lot of the, you know, a lot of artists definitely don't do that kind of work for free. So the thing that the route you're going is self-publishing. And what does that really entail, and how do you kind of go about starting that, especially shortly out of high school after finishing your first book? What were the steps that you took, and I guess how can people get a hold of your books?
Self-publishing is obviously easier than traditional publishing, but it's still a little tricky because you always have to find the right place to print it, you know, have somebody print it for you. You also need to follow page formats. You got to design the cover. I have a graphic design background, so designing the cover wasn't an issue for me. You know, some people might have to pay a good amount of money to get somebody to design a cover for them. So the process still could be a little tricky. Also, getting the feel for how you set up a book is also something you learn over time. You know, the actual structure of how the book is laid out. And as far as where anybody could get copies, right now I don't have them up yet. So, like, right now they're technically not buyable online yet, but I'm working on adding the store to my website by the end of this month.
And what is the website?
The website is www.archiveofthelastblow.com.
Archiveofthelastblow.com. So there's stuff up there now. There's a little bit of content up there now, but at this point, at this time, there's not a store. But there will be a store because you're going to need it. Because I don't know if you've ever heard of this thing called the Peppy Bump, but you're going to get a little traction right now. I mean, just on this show alone, about a year ago, I had a guest who, Kurt Clendenin, who was in a yacht rock band called Yachtly Crew, and at the time, back in May, they were California's number one yacht rock band. And I said, after this show, you're going to become the nation's number one yacht rock band. And that is exactly how they're billing themselves now. So that, you know, that was a thing that they decided to do, that I don't think there's really any poll out there saying, you know, who's your favorite yacht rock band across the nation? But maybe there is. Who knows? So that was something that they did. Look, there's when I was working at the nightclub, there was this band that opened for this other band. No one's ever heard of the headliners, but that band later on went on to become a really big name band known as the Killers. They were the Killers then too, but nobody knew that they were the Killers until after they encountered me at the club that I used to manage up in Burlington, Vermont. So I'm just saying, big things are on the horizon for you. You're going to have to start getting that shop ready, because I expect you're going to get at least one or two orders in the next couple of days.
Well, the shop should be up probably, I want to say, by the 10th or 11th of this month.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. So, I mean, around that time frame, so like between the 10th, I think the 10th is a Friday, so between that weekend area, it should be.
Oh, very good, very good. If, maybe we can work something out with Hercules, if, we can at least put a link to the interview on your site, I hope that would be okay with all parties involved. That way, you have a nice little audio clip to go with this. With the website, do you have a passage of some of your writing that you would like to share with us?
I do. I could read like a little bit part of the beginning of Limbo.
Okay, that one that definitely fascinates me. I also like the fact that there is an interconnectivity that will be expanded upon and fully revealed, I guess, with the 10th book. But I do like the idea that each of them does stand on their own. I do like that. That's a good way to go. That's the thing Stephen King would do. Stephen King, I would say 98% of his work, it all connects. And a lot of it through The Gunslinger, the Dark Tower series, but also like his Castle Rock, Maine series, how all that sort of connects and that he does it in very overt but also subtle ways. So I do love that concept. So yeah, hit us with a little bit of Limbo.
So this is off of the first page in Limbo. But before I read that first page real quick, just to interest you a little more with the table of contents area. It goes Limbo, Lust, Gluttony, Avarice, Wrath, Heresy, Ferocity, Hoax, Duplicity, Malevolence, and then there's two other, well, one other thing after that, but Malevolence is the bottom layer. And in most interpretations, you believe that, the center of hell is frozen over or ice based on what, the Divine Comedy states. For me, as you read, you'll learn that it has something completely different than that. There's something deeper than just a frozen, icy tundra. So reading into the first page, as my eyes opened, a bright mystical light prevented me from seeing clearly. After I picked myself up off the ground, it disappeared. I was in a clearing surrounded by woods on all sides. There was fog all over, a thick, murky fog. The ground looked decayed, like the grass was suffocating. With every step, I could hear whispers, voices mumbling. When I reached the trees at the start of my descent into the woods, I noticed something odd. They had sins carved into them, lust, gluttony, avarice, wrath, heresy, ferocity, hoax, duplicity, and malevolence. There was blood oozing from each marking, like the trees were alive. The fog got thicker and the whispers grew louder, so loud that they turned to screams of pain. People crying out for help, pleading for forgiveness and repenting. It got so bad that I felt gusts of wind from their screeches. Then everything grew softer as a new noise was made, a much more ominous sound. It was a heartbeat followed by loud running. Beat, stomp, stomp, beat, stomp, stomp, beat. After each stomp, it grew louder than the screams from before. I tried to hide behind a tree, as whatever it was approached. It sprinted by, chasing people that looked malnourished. Then it stopped as it caught some eating away at them as they screamed. That is when I truly got a good look at this creature. It looked pale, with light strands of hair barely covering its mutant-like human head. The body was on the heavier side, with scars, lesions, and blisters from head to claw. Its eyes were white, and its throat looked huge and saggy like a frog. But before I could analyze it more, the creature ran away after more people. Oh, just so you know, too, each creature that comes from the story, or anything that the main character really approaches, in the back of the book, there's a bestiary where they can
Oh, that's awesome. I love stuff. I love back matter. I love appendices, bestiaries, glossaries. I love that, especially in a work of fiction, too, that verisimilitude that sort of really helps create that world, that world building. And I got to say, man, for really creating a word picture and putting somebody in that environment, you really did a good job. You really captured that with that first page. It is very intriguing and is a very good opening salvo to what seems to be a very intense story. So kudos to you, man. Very well done. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Now one of the things we definitely wanted to talk about tonight is something that we both thoroughly enjoy, along with, I guess, millions of people across the country, because this really in the last few years caught on like wildfire, is a show called Cobra Kai. And for someone like me, who was 9 years old when the first Karate Kid came out in 1984. And I loved Rocky as a kid, especially as a young Italian-American kid. I've said this before on the show, growing up as a young Italian-American kid in the 70s and 80s, we had three icons. We had Sylvester Stallone, Lou Ferrigno, and Henry Winkler. Those were your three Italian-American entertainment icons. Yes, I know Henry Winkler is not Italian-American. He gets a bye. He's an honorary because of Fonzie, of Arthur Fonzarelli. And I will fight anybody on that. But anyway, Rocky was such a big part of my life growing up, and this was a movie. This was essentially Rocky for the younger set, directed by John Avildsen, who did the original Rocky as well. And, you know, what a great movie, especially, you know, the story of the kid from New Jersey moving out to California, not fitting in and finding, you know, that guidance and that mentor figure, and just, you know, again, a true underdog story that really, really resonated, I guess, with me, you know, at that young impressionable age. And then, of course, 2 years later was Karate Kid 2, and while it didn't have the same magic, I was still right there in that wheelhouse, that age bracket for it, you know. By the time the third one came out, I think I had grown the Karate Kid a little bit, so it took me a while to actually see that movie. I think I finally saw it several years after it came out. And then there was the next Karate Kid as well that, you know, I think I've seen bits and pieces of, but I don't know if I've seen that all the way through. So, you know, flash forward now to the show How I Met Your Mother, right, that started this whole sort of thing where Neil Patrick Harris's character idolized William Zabka's, Johnny character from The Karate Kid, who was the heavy, he was the bad guy, right? But in that character's eyes, it started this whole meme, essentially, of he was the real Karate Kid, that Johnny was the one who was wronged by Danny, it was really his story, and that he was the true hero, right? And it really was more of a statement and a a gag on Neil Patrick Harris's character on that show. But then it kind of steamrolls, and then William Zabka actually shows up on that show. Ralph Macchio shows up on that show. It becomes a recurring gag. And then it's through that they begin to develop this Cobra Kai show. And I think William Zabka was the big creative thrust behind that. And premiered on YouTube TV or something. It was a thing YouTube was trying at the time. And the first two seasons were on this YouTube. And it caught on then, but it really wasn't until it went to Netflix for the third season where it really took off. And the thing that makes this show great, besides the heavy nostalgia factor, is really just the character work. And I think you can agree that every character on this show is pretty much a multidimensional character. There's really shades of gray, right? No one is truly good or no one is truly bad. Like, even the bad guys are really well constructed, that you do find some sympathy or empathy in where they are coming from. And I know in particular you gravitated towards a character, Eli, or known as Hawk. And again, another great character arc. I mean, this show I love about this show is it combines crazy karate fights, right? It provides all that action, but with the drama of the great Canadian melodrama of that is Degrassi Junior High, original flavor, and most of Next Gen. Something that I love, and I see reflections of that in this show. So now, having not been around for that initial Karate Kid release like I was, did you were probably aware of the Karate Kid movies before the show started. But really, what was your relationship or how did you kind of find the show and latch onto it? And what do you like about the show?
So I watched the original ones, even though I didn't grow up with them. I liked them all a lot because Mr. Miyagi was always somebody that I gravitated towards.
Yeah.
He just was a very likable character. He was more of like that, mystical, like, he does stuff that like you didn't think really could be possible, but he makes it possible. He's also like that guardian that nobody can beat. He basically is the unbeatable guy. And the original movies really stuck with me when I watched Cobra Kai, because when I saw Ralph Macchio and I start to see all of them come out much older, I'm like, wow, they still look pretty similar to what they just a little bit older, but it really hits you. But unfortunately, Mr. Miyagi, the person who plays Mr. Miyagi couldn't be there.
Right.
But it is interesting noting that one of the last things he did, though, was in SpongeBob when he voiced for Karate Island, which is very funny. But in Cobra Kai, though, I got to say, like, in the show, they did such a great job, like you said, with the characterization. And it's character development like that that really impresses me and drives me to want to be more like that. Hawk especially, like Eli, I tend to gravitate a lot towards too in that show. He has a lot of character development, and I think that even after his character changes, it's still changing constantly. He, like you said, he's flipping the script, mm-hmm. He's got to be like the one character I like, but also besides him, I would have to say besides him, I like Johnny's character development a lot.
Oh, I mean, what William Zabka is doing on that show is great. I mean, he is really showing people that he's not that guy from the 80s, that he is a really solid actor and can do the high comedy bits, but can really do the melodramatic stuff really well and sells it really well. You really believe him in what he's doing.
Yeah, no, in the beginning of the show too, you feel really bad for him because, you know, the way everything is for him, because he was living under Daniel's shadow basically for a very, very long time. And
yeah, he was like frozen in amber. He was like a fly frozen in amber. He was, you know, he was stuck in that. Yeah. Yeah. He never grew past that.
And I mean, you can't really blame him because every time that he would turn on the TV or do something or read the newspaper, you know, Daniel's there with his legendary kick that, you know, he has to live with. But then, you know, as the story progresses and, you know, Kreese enters or Silver enters at the later area, it really, those entries of those characters really twist his character and make Johnny more, I don't want to say, like more warm-hearted, but also mm-hmm. Daniel's character changes too, because Daniel, you know, every situation in any situation, the good and bad is up to interpretation. You know, there's like, so in the original movies, Daniel was more of like a victim and Johnny was the aggressor. But when you look at it more, in some situations, Daniel also was the aggressor.
Would that become, that meme, that joke on How I Met Your Mother actually becomes a driving narrative thrust or character motivation in the show Cobra Kai. Because, yeah, in Johnny's eyes, Daniel was the one that ruined his life from day one, you know, which is brilliant, you know, to take something that was, sort of a gag and probably initially a one-off and just have this whole thing grow out of it. I thought was brilliant. Another thing that I think is really cool about the show, and I think that you might agree, is how they make these connections to characters and bring back characters from the original movies in ways that really do feel organic and don't necessarily always feel forced, right? And that it got to a point where they did it so well that everybody was predicting Miguel's father to be somebody else from the movies. And it just, you know, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen the last season of Cobra Kai, turns out to be someone not connected at all to the original trilogy. And now there's all these rumblings of Hilary Swank, right? Possibly showing up in the show at some point. And a lot of people have already predicted this, but is that it's Tori's mother, right? And what I think is brilliant about that is that we've technically already seen her, because Tori's mother has been in a hospital bed or a hospital type bed for the entire time we've seen her on the show, and you never see her face. And I think that if that reveal is Hilary Swank, it's genius, because it also kind of is a little bit of a callback to Million Dollar Baby, if anyone's seen that movie that she won, I think, an Academy Award for, where she also, spoiler alert for an almost 30-year-old movie, but where she winds up in a hospital bed after a boxing match or whatever she's doing in that. Great movie, though. Great movie, by the way. Clint Eastwood always delivers. And so another thing that's great about that show is they don't necessarily confine these references and connections to the Karate Kid trilogy. They reference other work in these people's career. A great line in the last season as well is when Danny and Johnny are talking to Kreese, trying to get Kreese to help them against Silver, you know, when Kreese is in jail. And Daniel says, I'm going to get one of my cousin lawyer, or I'm going to get a lawyer for you. And Kreese goes, make sure it's not one of your scumbag cousin lawyers, which is a direct reference to My Cousin Vinny, which Ralph Macchio was in, and Vinny, you know, Joe Pesci was his cousin who was the lawyer. And so I think that's like another level of the show and the writing that is just so brilliant that I really, as a movie fan in general, I just really appreciate.
And you forgot one of the best characters of all too in that show, which is Chosen.
What they've done with him. Oh man. Yeah. And that guy is just having a blast. You know, that's another thing about it. What makes a show work for me is when you can tell everybody doing it is having fun doing their job, right? And I think everybody on that show is just having a really good time, but none more than that actor who, you know, was a great heavy, great villain in Karate Kid 2, but really does just shine on this show, especially with this past season. And so this last season was season 5 or 4. I kind of lost count there.
Season 5, I think.
Season 5 just finished up. So we get one more season to wrap everything up. And then apparently there's going to be another, not connected, but another Karate Kid movie on the horizon, I guess is from recent news reports.
So I have a prediction on that. The Karate Kid movie that they haven't talked too much about yet, so they're saying that nobody from Cobra Kai will be in it so far. That's like the rumor. But I have a huge feeling that they might use Chosen to be the next Mr. Miyagi. That's just a theory.
Interesting.
Because I could see that happening, because Chosen is the most skilled that's not bad. And also, Chosen gives off a Mr. Miyagi vibe.
Yes.
He's very protective, and he also tends to into the show to talk. Well, Daniel and him talk about Mr. Miyagi a few times.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see if they do approach that, or it's interesting just to see how they even, because the new movie coming out is canon, and it's supposed to be the next one in the series.
Right, after the next Karate Kid, yeah. Because it's not going to be tied into the Jaden Smith one at all. That, I think, is just going to stand on its own.
Now, the Jaden Smith one is not considered a part of the Miyagi-verse, because Mr. Miyagi was never in it.
Right. And so, yeah, it'll be very interesting to see what happens, but, again, really looking forward to at least one more season, I guess, if we are correct on our numbers. There's 2 seasons on YouTube and then 3 seasons on Netflix with one more to wrap it all up. And I really hope they do it justice. And I think 6 seasons is good. Then they kind of can go out on a high note and not really have it devolve or jump the shark or become a parody of itself, which sometimes happens to things that start off as brilliantly as this one has.
And the last season is going to have to do with that tournament, too.
Yes, it's all going to build to the tournament, which, again, is really funny when you think of the first 3 movies. The first 3 movies essentially take place about a year and a half apart, or start and then finish in the span of a year and a half, even though it took something like 4 or 5 years for them to all come out, because that's the third one ends with the tournament that's a year after the end of the first movie. And and again, what a great way to bring back the Mike Barnes character in this one, and just kind of, you know, again, buck more expectations, you know, you're thinking he's going to come in this one role and kind of plays this whole different side and this different role that still fits and just works really well within the confines of the show. So now so obviously you do have a reverence for the 80s, a decade that you were probably at the tail end of it, right? If I'm guessing correctly.
Well, I was born in 94, so.
You were born in 94. Oh boy. So you do have a bit of a reverence for the 80s, and because again, 80s, there's certain things like Karate Kid, you know, that transcend, I think, their time period. You're a big video game fan, and you do have a specific love for video games of the late 70s and 80s, correct?
Yes, I always have a passion of, you know, knowing more about older video games, you know, the history behind them, and yeah, I mean, they've always excited me more than the modern ones. Not that there's anything wrong with the modern ones. It's just the older ones have a distinct feel to them.
Right. And how did this love for classic video games start?
This love for classic video games basically started when actually really jump started when my brother and I opened up our own video game store together back in 2018.
Okay.
So back way when, you know, we both liked video games, you know, and I didn't know a lot at the time about different video games. I knew some things, but mm-hmm. from people coming in and getting new inventory in and playing things and testing things, I started to get a more of a feel of everything.
Hmm. And it's sort of like, you know, it's a, is it specifically like the old Atari ColecoVision type stuff? Early Nintendo as well.
So Atari, yeah. Even older Magnavox Odyssey I've played. Yeah, I'm going way back now. ColecoVision, obviously, and Television. Obviously, original Nintendo, you know, Super Nintendo, which came out a little bit later. I've even played a Commodore 64.
Cool.
So like that, you know, it's Sega Master System. So I go all the way back.
I remember having Pong when I was very, very young. I remember Pong. And then I remember getting a ColecoVision, and Donkey Kong on ColecoVision was sick. That was great for, you know, that would have been like 81, 82, I guess. And so I was like 6, 7. And then we got the Atari adapter for the ColecoVision. So I had a ton of Atari games as well, including E.T. I had a copy of E.T. That game exists. That game was in circulation. And I have played that game. And then I do remember getting one of the early Nintendos, the one that came with the Duck Hunt and Hogan's Alley. So you had the gun, but it also came with Gyromite, and you had that robot. And that was kind of a neat thing. That was a very, very involved and complicated build just to play a video game, because you had to put the robot in the track and all the gyros and everything. And it was very akin to the game, the board game Mousetrap, if anyone's ever played Mousetrap. And that thing, as much of a pain to set it up was, when you got that going, it was pretty cool. It was really, really cool. But for obvious reasons, that never really caught on. I don't know if you ever had a chance to play Gyromite with the full robot setup, but it is a very, very neat experience. And then that was it for me. I never got a Sega Genesis. I never got a early Sony PlayStation. I have a PlayStation 3. I have a PS3 right now that I really just use to watch Blu-rays on, and occasionally I'll play a really bad superhero movie video game adaptation. That's sort of my thing right now, as far as I had been when I was kind of playing video games a lot more than I do now. With the really bad, you know, the first Iron Man movie adaptation game, the Captain America game, Thor game, the Hulk game, tech games that are just not great. I will say that one standout would be the Wolverine Origins video game adaptation for PS3, if anybody else still has one of those. Far better than the movie, and one of the bloodiest, most violent video games that I've ever played. But I know there's far more out there, but yeah, that one's worth a shot. That one. What are your current video games that you enjoy playing as far as modern video games?
As far as modern video games go, I stick to like horror based stuff. So like Dead Space is a horror game that I play. You know, I play games like God of War. I'm all over the spectrum in terms of genres. I also play Fortnite, play Call of Duty.
Cool.
I play Dead by Daylight, so it's a mixture, really.
I have never played any of those games, but I'm sure they're fun. I love horror movies. I love reading a horror novel or a horror comic. Horror video game I don't know. I just, for some reason, I just, that there's, you feel always, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like it really wouldn't work. It wouldn't, I know there's game, people have said, oh, this game is terrifying. This sequence in this game is absolutely terrifying. I don't know. I don't know how it could be terrifying. I just, to me. But again, I'm not, and yet I've gotten worked up on video games. Like, look, the Arkham Asylum game, has, you know, I've definitely got anxious, nervous, angry, excited while playing that game. But terrified? I don't know. I don't know. There's always another life in a video game. You just hit restart and you go again.
Well, that's why you got to do VR.
Ah, there you go. There you go. So Alex, we have about 4 minutes left. And I, you know, one thing I just really want to touch on really quick. I know that you have started working out recently, and I just want you to give us, you know, about a minute of what you have found with your benefits of weight training that you have started in the last several months. How you, if you feel better now than you did before?
So the weight training, I basically just do, you know, it's like a stress reliever. It's made me more energetic. It's made me more awake, you know, more focused. So it's just a good way to keep myself in check. That's really what it is. So yeah, that's all I have to say on that.
Right,
it just keeps me focused.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, you know, you were someone, when I first met you, you very much impressed me with your wit and your humor and your, like I said before, your stick-to-itiveness, your willingness to overcome fears and tackle them head-on was also a very standout part of your personality that I always appreciated when, you know, I had to put you in the front lines in the war that is holiday retail. In a mall in New Jersey. You know, I've talked about with you about one of my favorite philosophies of Bruce Lee, one of the greatest philosophers, I think, of many generations. But his be like water, right? Sometimes water crashes, so crash. Sometimes water flows, so flow. But, you know, water is malleable, and yet it can run free, you know. Be like water. And you, Alex, are like water, my friend. And I appreciate you. I appreciate the effort that you put into your writing, the enthusiasm that you have for it. So, again, I want to direct everybody to www.archiveofthelastblow.com, that website. Be on the lookout for that store to open up, and start buying these books, because they sound fantastic. I look forward to reading them myself, and I really, you know, let's move a lot of paper. Let's get this kid the money he needs so he can, you know, take this to a big publisher and hire artists and turn it into graphic novels and get that inevitable, you know, movie or TV deal going, so he can, and he can become a huge, huge success. And he can forget all about me. But for now, again, I really appreciate you being here. Hit that website, archiveofthelastblow.com. Alex, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having
and
me.
It's my pleasure having you, man. And I really, really hope that this helps you to stay inspired, to keep writing, and to get all 70 of those out sooner than I think you think you're going to get them out. And folks, this has been the Pep Talk for February 5th, 2023. Thank you for listening. I'm John Carl Pepe. You can always find me at the Joker's Child in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Come by. There I'm called Phil. But either way, give me a high five, and I'm going to sell you some comics. Hercules, thank you for having me. And we'll talk to you in a month, folks. Be good to each other.
Be well. You too. Take care. Good night, everybody.